The Tom Woods Show, episode 2134.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. We have a couple of special guests on the program today. John Leake is a best-selling author who has partnered with Dr. Peter McCullough on a new book, The Courage to Face COVID-19, Preventing Hospitalization and Death While Battling the Biopharmaceutical Complex. Surely you are familiar with Dr. McCullough by now, certainly as a result of his famous, perhaps infamous, interview with Joe Rogan. But before that, he was a very high-profile figure in the battle against COVID. He is an internist, cardiologist, and epidemiologist who's been a leader in the medical response to COVID-19. In August 2020, he published Pathophysiological Basis and Rationale for Early Outpatient Treatment of SARS-CoV-2 Infection in the American Journal of Medicine. And that paper presented the first synthesis of sequenced multi-drug treatment of ambulatory patients infected with the virus and was subsequently updated in Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine. He's published dozens of peer-reviewed papers on the infection and has testified on several occasions in the U.S. Senate and before several state Senate and congressional committees. So let's get right into the conversation. Let me start off actually kind of toward the end of our story, if I may, and use my podcast host privilege to ask a question that so many of my listeners would like a clear, unambiguous answer to. And I know that the bulk of the story in this book, which is a very, very interesting one, has to do with early treatment, you know, trying to prevent hospitalization in the first place, and how that relates to the vaccination campaign. But what's been on so many people's minds is we keep seeing over and over claims that the unvaccinated have suffered disproportionately. And I saw recently a study saying we would have saved another 300,000 lives in the U.S. if we had had more robust vaccination taking place. And yet on the other side, I hear people saying, oh, no, actually the vaccination process has actually not been all that effective for people and may actually have done some harm. I don't know how to sort through all these numbers. And I think my listeners are having trouble too. Can one of you help us understand the truth of that issue?
Yeah, I'll take that up. Tom, thanks for having us on the program. The randomized trials that were done of the COVID-19 vaccines are considered by the FDA the only rights to claim what the vaccines do. So the randomized trials were done in ostensibly healthy people during the wild type alpha outbreaks. And there, they reduced the binary occurrence of COVID-19 respiratory illness at home. They did not influence rates of hospitalization or death whatsoever. What had happened after that was a series of reports. So we were getting reports from England, Scotland, Europe, and South Africa showing that large numbers of vaccinated were landing up in the hospital, that it wasn't stopping hospitalization. And then at the same time, this was during 2021, we were receiving just a flurry of reports saying that everyone in the hospital was unvaccinated, that it was a crisis of the unvaccinated. In fact, one time on TV, there seemed to be an issued talking point where there was at least 24 different people all over the country saying it's a crisis of the unvaccinated. And when we dug into it, this is what we found out. We found out that most electronic medical records in the hospital assume some unvaccinated unless they prove in some way that they are vaccinated. No one comes in the rooms because they're in isolation. Most people probably don't bring their vaccine cards because they've come to the hospital under duress. So the first point is the electronic records assume they're unvaccinated. So it's easy for hospital administrators to just generate a report that everyone's unvaccinated. Number two, there's differential testing. The CDC has always said if you're unvaccinated, even if you have an ankle sprain or coming in for electrosurgery, you need a test. But if you're vaccinated, you don't need a test. So there's differential testing was trumping up the numbers for the unvaccinated. Number three is that there's no adjudication. So none of these studies actually check to see if they had COVID, looking at the x-rays and the tests. And so no confirmation of a COVID diagnosis for these hospitalized patients. And then number four, and this is very important, is, you know, the data are not randomized in these large-scale populations. Most of them are just case-controlled data. So we basically had a, in a sense, a fraudulent data set coming out in the medical literature that the unvaccinated were ending up in the hospital. And then finally, there was capitulation. So in December 10th of 2021, the CDC just came out with an announcement that 79% of all COVID cases were in the fully vaccinated.
Well, as long as we're on this vaccine question, let's do one more question on that, and then we'll get to the beginning of the story. Does it make sense right now, he asks rhetorically, that we have a situation where in order to enter the United States, and still some countries, there's still some countries where you have to show vaccine proof to get into the country. When these vaccines were developed, when the virus had taken a different form from the form it has now, some people are saying, well, it's pointless to be administering this vaccine now because the virus itself is so different. Is that a legitimate criticism?
It is. Our CDC director has come out and said mid-2021, the vaccines don't work. They don't stop spread of the infection. There'd be no reason to check vaccine status at a border or going into a public place. And then we've had case after case. I mean, we've had Anderson Cooper get COVID after three shots and Bill Gates after four shots and Kamala Harris after three shots. And we just had Jake Tapper test positive. You know, all the people in the media who are fully vaccinated and getting COVID, it's obvious the vaccines don't work. So they should be dropped completely. There's no sense of trying to have that as a barrier for entry into a country.
If I could maybe add something, Dr. McCullough would be in a position to evaluate this idea. Two things that jump out to me about the mass vaccination campaign that we can get into. There was such a massive commitment to the vaccine solution to SARS-CoV-2. And as we discovered and documented in our book, there's so much fraudulent misrepresentation. You have to consider, just follow the logic, that massive commitment to this monolithic solution, a skeptical person or a person who isn't naive is going to have to take a skeptical posture about these claims that are made. It's a epidemic of the unvaccinated. I mean, we're going to have to look at the evidence of that. That goes without saying, perhaps, but I think as your listeners will hear, fraud is such a major part of this story. There's been just massive fraud in the academic literature, all kinds of representations that have been made. So I think it's following the same fraudulent spirit that we need to examine this. The other thing, and I won't belabor the point, but I think we have to consider what epidemiologists call a confounding variable. I think it's quite interesting to contemplate. If you look at the United States, at a map of the United States, it's obviously a very divided country. It almost seems like we've divided into two separate tribes. And it's a generalization, but I think it's worth considering. The common sense crowd, the people who retained what Orwell would call just good political instincts and common sense, even if they don't have a lot of education and intellectual sophistication, that common sense crowd, it's these red states. And if you compare the overall health complexion of red states, to give a sort of archetypal example, the girl that lives in Santa Monica and is fit as a fiddle and goes jogging on the beach every day, she thinks that it's her vaccine that is keeping her from getting sick with COVID-19. But it's, in fact, she's just a healthy girl that gets lots of exercise and sunshine and has a good diet. If you go into red states, as we know, we have these underlying metabolic illnesses, obesity and diabetes and so forth. So I think it's the underlying medical conditions that are what we should be examining, and not whether it's the vaccine that's keeping people from getting sick.
Let's go maybe toward the beginning of the story. And the story really is that COVID-19 comes onto the scene. Dr. McCullough's instinct is the instinct of a great many people, which is, let's see what kind of treatments we can come up with, and preferably treatments that keep people out of the hospital in the first place. And he's met with a really strange, I mean, bizarre, almost inexplicable. Inexplicable, assuming that everybody is acting out of goodwill, inexplicable level of hostility toward that very idea. And at the same time, is faced with claims, of course, obviously after Joe Rogan, claims of misinformation is all over the place when it comes to this virus. There's so much misinformation. We have to fight misinformation. But the whole story in this book, The Courage to Face COVID-19, is precisely the opposite, that the misinformation is coming from the official sources.
It's true. You know, our Surgeon General recently had a poll. He put on the internet and said, where's COVID misinformation coming from? And the majority responded, said it's coming from the federal agencies. That's actually the difficulty there. But you know, I was following every single press briefing. I was working feverishly to develop FDA-approved protocols, which I did, investigational drug applications, organized my research team. I never heard once any government official state the problem. The problem was people were getting sick with SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19 infection, largely our seniors and those with medical problems, and they were being hospitalized or worse, they would die. So the problem was hospitalization and death. What we needed is we needed a solution to prevent hospitalization and death. Nobody actually articulated this. They started focusing on, in my view, a very unrealistic goal. And the unrealistic goal was to try to eradicate the disease, try to get to zero cases. Pretended like this was smallpox or polio, that we're going to put people in isolation and snuff out every last case. It was almost as if it was a vaccine developer's dream to have a viral pandemic and get rid of every last case. And I can tell you as a doctor looking at a respiratory illness like this, I knew from the beginning we weren't going to get to zero cases.
But I guess the thing that is so hard for me to wrap my head around, I guess it has to do with something you said to Joe Rogan, because he wants to know, all right, you make a pretty good case that there are some early treatments. And of course, there are a couple of drugs that the layman has heard of. Of course, we've heard of ivermectin, we've heard of hydroxychloroquine, but the response to this has been hysterical, over the top, fact-free, exaggerated, whatever. What could possibly account for this? And when you were on with Tucker Carlson, you said something along the lines of something is up. And he asked you, he pinned you down on that and said, I want you to flesh that out a little bit more when you say something is up. What exactly is up? And I think the thing that's up is very, very hard for many people to accept. So what is up?
This is the theme of our book, that Tucker Carlson question that he posed to Dr. McCullough, and then Dr. McCullough wanted to remain in his lane as a doctor. That's what prompted me to contact him here in Dallas. So what is up is there was going at least back as far as 2017, a series of pandemic planning exercises. The question was, how are we going to respond to the next pandemic, which by their assertion was imminent? It was going to come at any time. So these were held at Georgetown and Johns Hopkins in 2017. And then there was another notable one in October of 2019. And the solution that arises from these pandemic planning exercises, but I'll add to that a new organization that was founded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the World Economic Forum called CEPI, the Center for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. The solution to the imminent pandemic that was set forth was rapid vaccine development and mass deployment. And there's not, for example, CEPI, I think you're listeners will find this interesting. They actually circulated a business plan for how are we going to respond to the next pandemic? And the 65-page business plan is devoted 100% to rapidly developing and deploying a vaccine. And there's not a single word in the document about treatment, about therapy. So when SARS-CoV-2 arrives, it just activated the CEPI business plan. And any talk of treatment, of therapies, of repurposed drugs was immediately categorically shot down even before there was sufficient time to examine whether there might be something to it. So what we conclude as we work through this story is that early treatment was deliberately suppressed in the way that a monopolist suppresses the competition for his products. I mean, we think of John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil just kind of breaking the kneecaps of any competition for his oil. Or we think of another monopolist who was compared to John Rockefeller around the year 2000, Bill Gates. So like Rockefeller, Gates starts this foundation and he becomes fanatically devoted and obsessed, I would say, with vaccines. Vaccines, it's the only game in town to public health. And according to this, what we call the biopharmaceutical complex. So early treatment was just suppressed. The only thing that we can do, Bill Gates himself wrote in a Washington Post op-ed in April, in a long interview with Trevor Noah in April, all we can do is all stay at home, socially isolate, and wait for a vaccine. This is explicitly stated and repeated like a mantra.
It's just, I think, hard for a layman, maybe somebody who is naive about the way the world works, to hear that because it seems so perverse. It's hard, I think, for people to wrap their head around the possibility that somebody could be so devoted to his preferred approach as to dismiss and disparage all alternatives that might nevertheless have saved lives. It's hard. I mean, you recognize it's hard for people to grasp that.
We go into the psychology, which has been fairly well described and documented in other settings, the military industrial complex. We saw this string of corporate scandals in the United States in the early 2000s, Enron being a notable one, WorldCom, the Bernie Madoff scandal. And what seems to be happening, this is an anthropological observation, is that when humans are engaged in an enterprise that offers the promise of great gain, material gain, a sort of esprit de corps sets in, an excitement, a voracity to pursue this project. I think of it as perhaps deriving from Paleolithic times. A hunting party would get together, you know, these brave young warriors and hunters, and they would have the prospect of a big kill of, you know, some herd animal. And so there's a kind of an excitement, a sort of a frisson, a voracity of the prospect of great gain. And people who are engaged in these enterprises, there's an ethical part of the human cognition that seems to be sort of switched off. People in this context of pursuing such an enterprise, that they don't have the same ethical perception of the world that they would, for example, with family and friends. So this is a big part of our story. It's the sort of dark, atavistic side of human nature that I think we moderns are inclined to ignore, or we're not fully aware of it, or it's upsetting to contemplate, but it's very real. And the totality of circumstances that we document demonstrates that this is what's happened.
Can we go back to 2020? There was an article in The Lancet, which is, of course, as everybody knows, an extremely prestigious publication, that argued that hydroxychloroquine was both ineffective and potentially dangerous. And that article was ultimately withdrawn under pressure. But in your book, you say that even though the article was withdrawn, still a significant amount of damage was done. What was the story there?
The story there is that a few Harvard faculty that are, you know, people who have pretty good academic reputations published a paper in Lancet from a fake database from a company called Surgisphere, a company that basically disappeared, claimed to have data from back in December, January, February, early on in the pandemic, on thousands of people hospitalized with COVID. And so they ran analyses, one published in Lancet, that hinted that hydroxychloroquine may not have a beneficial effect. It wasn't really swinging towards harm very significantly. But everything about it looked concocted. The average age of people in that paper was in their 40s. That looked fraudulent because, you know, we are seeing patients hospitalized in their 80s, not their 40s. And this hung up on the Lancet server for 2 weeks, and then it was taken down really without any explanation. Lancet said, we can't verify the data. A similar paper was published in New England Journal of Medicine, and it had to do with ACE inhibitors, a commonly used drug for high blood pressure and for heart failure and kidney disease from the same group. And that was pulled down as well. The point that we make is that this paper in Lancet became this lightning rod for those who were really, really excited to claim that hydroxychloroquine didn't work or potentially dangerous. This was really what they were looking for. You know, the National Institutes of Health dropped their very large clinical trial of using hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin. They had sketched out 2,000 patients. They had sites. They had distributed the drug. They had everything ready to go for a large trial. And the NIH said, well, we're not going to do it. We only collected 20 patients. And they gave up on a clinical trial, which is basically completely unethical to do that. And then the FDA came out with a statement, and they said hydroxychloroquine should not be used, period, for treating COVID-19. They revisited that. They had pulled their only clinical trial of hydroxychloroquine as an outpatient, and that's really where we were utilizing it. And this was all part of, in many ways, a complete fraud cooked up against hydroxychloroquine. And I told Tucker Carlson, the war against hydroxychloroquine started when former President Trump mentioned that it could work, and Didier Raoult in France had done early work. In Australia, they put a law in the books early in April. They put a doctor in jail if the doctor used hydroxychloroquine. All the events with the Lancet fraudulent paper and the FDA, Rick Bright was blocking hydroxychloroquine stockpile, which the U.S. had gathered. Peter Navarro had called me to ask me to help him try to release this EUA or expand it so we can get hydroxychloroquine utilized. The emergency use authorization of hydroxychloroquine was effectively a restriction. Hydroxychloroquine was already on the market. It didn't need market entry with an emergency use authorization, but it got worse. In France, they ended up pulling it from over the counter and making it really hard to get. And then nefariously, the second largest hydroxychloroquine manufacturing plant outside of Taipei burns to the ground with no explanation.
Before I go on, let me say a quick thing that will help a lot of you, and you know who you are. If you are in business and you're getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO, our great sponsor. If you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis, well, website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. If you're tired of cold calling, use your website as a lead generation engine. If you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, then get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. When I had RFK on the show, we talked about the approval process for COVID of remdesivir and the weird twists and turns it took. So that story, even Bill Gates said something screwy about the approval for remdesivir. But meanwhile, you have these other treatments where you don't have to do all these twists and turns in order to show good outcomes, and yet there's this massive campaign against them. How have they continued to work? And by they, I mean hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin. How have they continued, and also any other treatments that you've been using, how have they worked against the variants where we've seen that people have said that the vaccines have had less and less effect? What about these early treatments? How have they done against the variants?
Well, the Delta variant, I remember having a meeting with Dr. McCullough and September of 2021. And when he said to me, this one actually surprisingly looks like people are, from his own patients, deduced that Delta was actually maybe even more troublesome for some patients than the original Alpha. And I believe, as I recall our discussions of this, that early treatment worked with the same efficacy against Delta as it did with the original wild variant of this thing, the treatment protocol was not changed at all and similar efficacy. The point of these early treatment modalities is if you identify that the patient has a high risk profile over 65, has some underlying health conditions like diabetes, for example, you have to get them on these treatments early and in combination. As we document in our book, and as the Yale professor Harvey Risch is always keen to point out, if you wait for the patient to land in hospital, you've moved beyond the viral replication phase. The patient is much sicker and requires other treatments. So we also talk about the anti-inflammatory and antithrombotic treatments, which are more addressing the symptoms of someone who's really sick. Once we get to Omicron, it really is more like a common cold. And I know that Dr. McCullough expressed to me in December of 2021 how impressed he was by these nasal rinses, which were effective against all variants. I'll let Dr. McCullough talk about this. I think it's such a remarkable part of the story.
Yeah, what we had learned is that a virus really starts in the nasal cavity and replicates for days before it invades the body. So there's an opportunity to get something up in the nasal cavities to kill the virus or knock it down so the body can handle it. And as the virus mutated from wild type to alpha to delta and then to Omicron in the United States, the replication speed increased, particularly with Omicron. It had gotten up to 70 times faster than Delta. So this virus was basically spinning like a top in the nasal cavity. And so through 2020, and then published early in 2021, key papers on using what's called virucidal washes. The lead one is povidone iodine, but there are others, hydrogen peroxide, there is colloidal silver, a whole variety of other agents that work to basically kill the virus or don't let the virus replicate. And so there were 12 clinical studies, three large randomized trials, the best known is by Chowdhury and colleagues from Bangladesh, that clearly showed they had 303 patients in each group randomized. Those who did the nasal washes with povidone iodine, they basically became PCR negative within 3 days. And otherwise, you know, large proportions stay positive for weeks afterwards. So it cut down the contagion massively, which is a huge finding. And then secondly, those who did the nasal washes had a much lower rate of being hospitalized or needing oxygen or heaven forbid dying. And it was such a simple upfront maneuver that we immediately brought that into the treatment protocols. The Association of American Physicians and Surgeons had a treatment protocol. The Frontline Critical Care Network had one. The protocol that we have within AAPS is copyrighted, the McCullough protocol, so iCullough protocol, with the virucidal nasal washes. And this became a valuable installation. But the drugs worked all the way through for unique reasons. Hydroxychloroquine has at least three mechanisms of action. It reduces the endosomal entry of the virus into the it carries in zinc, which inhibits the polymerase, and then it's an anti-inflammatory. Ivermectin separately actually is the only drug that works against the dangerous spike protein or the outside spine, reduces nuclear entry of the virus. And then lastly, it has certain changes in kinases within the cell protoplasm. This is very different than the drugs that came later, Revlimid, which is basically a combination of two protease inhibitors. So it just works on one enzymatic process for viral replication, and then molnupiravir, which is a polymerase inhibitor, remdesivir, a simple polymerase inhibitor. So everything at that viral level is useful, but in alone is neither necessary nor sufficient. We learn through randomized trials, we need inhaled steroids, budesonide, oral steroids, prednisone, dexamethasone, hydrocortisone. We need oral inflammatories, colchicine, aspirin, blood thinners, and we need a combination of drugs. So last night I did a film shoot for major national TV, and they were asking about Paxlovid rebounds after 5 days of Paxlovid not getting over the syndrome. I said, well, you know, we've known this for 2 years. We use drugs in combination. In fact, for our sicker patients, we end up using hydroxychloroquine a month, as I did in my father, and that's in the book.
Yes. In fact, I made a little note about the story about your father. I hadn't known that. And you treated him just the way you would want anybody else to be treated, which goes to show, I'm sure there are some people, by the way, who have made, I haven't looked, but I would take a wild guess. There are a lot of people who have made horrible accusations toward you. I would assume that they, some of them probably think you're a murderer because you don't support the mass vaccination effort. But yet here you are, this is your own father.
I can tell you no one to my face or even so boldly in an email has ever made a claim against me or accused me of doing anything wrong or improper in medicine. Now, what's happened is anonymous, uncredentialed fact checkers have made false counterclaims. And these fact checkers are out there on the internet. We're not sure who supports them, but there are now fact checking networks. We've fact checked a couple of them that actually had an identity, and they fact checked pretty quickly back to the vaccine stakeholders, that they're out making false counterclaims, trying to undermine any efforts on early treatment in order to promote the vaccine agenda.
You know, I would like to add that I approach this story as a true crime author. Before I wrote this with Dr. McCullough, I had written a couple of true crime books. And what I found very intriguing at the beginning of this thing in February and March of 2020, as doctors like Dr. McCullough and others were scrambling to find early treatment, it focused on hydroxychloroquine, which obviously we've mentioned, but it's really fascinating, and we document this in the book, the history of hydroxychloroquine and why it was perceived to be a potentially valuable agent in treating this, especially in combination with azithromycin and zinc. And we devote quite a bit of time to this marvelous professor in Marseille, France, named Didier Raoul, who's really one of the great microbiologists in history. I mean, he's just a remarkable character and has a larger-than-life personality. But for 20 years, he studied hydroxychloroquine as an agent with a wide array of salutary benefits against a number of microbes. And I think the reader will find that very intriguing. The other thing about hydroxychloroquine is that it has powerful anti-inflammatory qualities, and it has an effect in modulating what's called a cytokine, a protein that is produced by the immune system. In this case, it's interleukin-6, which correlates very strongly with people who are overweight, with adipose, people who have excess amount of fat. Interleukin-6 is very prevalent in this so-called cytokine storm. And we knew from an Israeli study in 2012 that hydroxychloroquine modulates interleukin-6 production. So there are a number of reasons to believe that hydroxychloroquine could be helpful. It's also a World Health Organization essential medication. Its natural ancestors, quinine, which goes back to the 16th century, is an anti-malarial. And its obvious anti-inflammatory qualities are known to rheumatologists. It's long been a standard for treating rheumatoid arthritis. So what we see with the way the mainstream media and some of these federal health agencies, the way they treated hydroxychloroquine is just a crude propaganda campaign. I mean, a crude and cartoonish propaganda campaign was waged against it. So that raises the question of why. Why would you wage a crude and cartoonish, just absurd propaganda campaign against a safe old drug, which is cheap? That's the other thing. It's easy to manufacture. So anyway, I could go on, but this is a big part of the early chapters of our book.
John, I would just jump in there and say, I think the reason why hydroxychloroquine was vilified so much in the first year, and then equally so, or even more so, ivermectin in the second year, is because they really worked. Do you know other things that were tried that didn't work, like lopinavir and cyproheptadine and what have you? There was no campaign against those drugs.
Right.
It was interesting. The campaign was against the drugs that really worked, because if people could get through the illness relatively easily with some generic available drugs worldwide, they would be less likely to buy into the mass vaccination program.
All right. I want to respect your time. So I have a couple more questions I want to ask, particularly to Dr. McCullough. I mean, you're a physician. You have a history in academia. This is not the kind of occupation where you expect to be a nationally known figure almost overnight and to have the country kind of divide into camps, whether they like you or not, when most of them aren't even qualified to evaluate, you know, your work. I cannot imagine what that would be like, particularly after the Joe Rogan episode, because your episode with Joe Rogan is really, frankly, then Dr. Malone, but you really are what provoked the whole thing about Spotify and they should drop him and he should censor the episodes and all that. Can you describe for us what it's like to be, you know, let's say a fairly prominent person in your field, but not a national name, suddenly to being at the center of a massive controversy?
I was thrown into the public limelight. There's no doubt about it. When I look back on it, I think the real breakout time was when I testified before America in the U.S. Senate in November 2020. I was the lead witness, and I was basically telling America point blank, we can treat this illness, and if we don't get going treating it, we're going to end up, this is going to become a slaughterhouse. Thank goodness early treatment kicked in and kept our hospitalizations below the cresting level in January of 2021. That was really our battle. The bulge was January of 2021. After that, hospitalization rates went down precipitously and they never really came back. The hospitals managed things from that point forward. The only people hospitalized, honestly, from that point forward were those who were being denied early treatment. People were getting early treatment. They were getting through the illness. And then after that, I testified in the U.S. Senate in March, or the Texas Senate in March of 2021. And that's where I went on fire. And I started frying these lawmakers saying, listen, where are the monoclonal antibodies? We heard about suppression of hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. But what about monoclonal antibodies, which are safe and effective? No one can find them. There's no access numbers for these. It was clear they were being suppressed. In fact, all forms of early treatment were being suppressed. The nasal washes we talked about were suppressed. There were emails going out to doctors saying, don't use iodine washes. People could swallow them. It'll cause iodine poisoning. I mean, people had been doing this. Ophthalmologists and ENT doctors have been doing this for years. Then I had the breakout Tucker Carlson interview. I was so rattled after my Tucker Carlson interview. I said, listen, Tucker's onto something. He knows something is up. I can't spill the beans because I don't know what the worldwide pot is, but something's going on. And Tucker started going crazy. He had texted me the next day and I said, listen, you got to get some investigative journalists on this. It was around that time I started working with John and we started saying, listen, we've got something for a book. And then you're right, you bring it on down to Joe Rogan. When I went on with Rogan, I had a sense that this could be explosive. And I showed up, unlike Tucker Carlson, I showed up with my computer and slides. I had curated scientific slides. Every point I was going to make, I sent them to the Spotify producers, Rogan's people. I showed up there and all we did was go over the data. Rogan asked very fair questions, gave me lots of time to answer. And what really blew that interview open was his reaction. It was Rogan's reaction as a reasonable person, a pretty smart person. And that's what caught fire with that interview. And he normally gets, you know, a certain amount of downloads on Spotify. We had doubled, tripled, quadrupled them. And then Spotify started seeing that and the White House got involved, Prince Harry, Neil Young, everyone's, oh, Rogan's spreading misinformation. So as this whole thing came out, I said, listen, you know, which slide do you think is misinformation? Which study do you want to go over? Quickly, people got off me and said, oh, Dr. McCullough, you're not the problem. You're not spreading misinformation. It was Rogan. And it's really not, it's really about Rogan said about racial terms using the N-word, you know, years ago. And I'm like, what? I thought this was about misinformation. Yeah, now they're trying to hang Rogan on something. So Rogan's come out with a video about his use of the N-word and how it's taken out of context, you know, how other people have used it in a phrase. And he still says, listen, there's no excuse for it. But this whole thing started out as misinformation on Joe Rogan, but quickly, when I came out strong to say, listen, let's go over the data. In fact, I tweeted to Jen Psaki in the White House. I said, listen, there's 1,000 papers on vaccine injuries, 1,000 peer-reviewed publications, 200 on myocarditis. I'll come in, I'll visit the president, the surgeon general, bring in all the government officials, and we'll go over all the vaccine injury published papers. Oh, nobody had any interest in that.
All right, here's the last thing I want to ask you. If I had asked you in 2019, what do you think are the primary problems in American medicine or with the American medical establishment, how would your answer have been different in 2019 than your answer in 2022?
In 2019, I would have said the usual things, you know, access to care, medicalization of social problems, costs, etc. I can tell you in 2021, I'll tell you right now, is a complete loss of moral integrity, a complete and total loss of the compass of putting the patient first. I'm astonished how doctors turn their patients down on early treatment. They never threw them the life preserver to even get a chance on being saved. They sat back and let the virus slaughter their patients or put them in the hospital. We had 1 million patients die, 10 million people hospitalized. By my estimate, because it was a learning curve, my estimate now is that probably 2/3, looking back, could have been saved. It could have been spared all that misery. And then in 2021, how the doctors got in lockstep on the vaccines. And as the vaccines, you know, we found out within a month or two that the vaccines weren't safe and people were being damaged and dying with them. How the doctors actually doubled and tripled down and pushed the vaccines on their patients, causing more death, heart damage, blood clots, and destruction. I tell you right now, medicine in the last 2 years has been absolutely, they've basically done it to themselves.
And yet, it's hard to see what the way forward is because there are at least implicit threats that if a doctor says the wrong thing, he could get in serious trouble. His career could be destroyed. In some cases, his license could be revoked. It's hard to know how to rebuild.
New England Journal of Medicine in the last 2 weeks put out an ad that said it's time for institutions to start identifying which doctors are spreading misinformation. And I took that graphic and I put published manuscripts on vaccine injuries and deaths on it. And I said, listen, I want any institution who has the courage to talk with me about this to come out and talk with me about this. This is a giant game of brinkmanship. And they are trying to use fear and intimidation tactics to suppress the truth.
I would like to add to that that you look at these instances in history in which very large complexes of money and manufacturing and a complex of interests commit to a major enterprise. I think the First World War is a very notable example of an enterprise which was predicted after the Franco-Prussian War. Everybody knew it was going to come to blows between France and Germany. Probably going to happen in Belgium. And so there were all kinds of planning in advance and preparation for what was perceived to be probably an inevitable military conflict. And once the Archduke was assassinated in Sarajevo and the train left the station, what you see is an enormous reluctance when it doesn't work out. The von Schlieffen plan doesn't work out according to plan. There's a reluctance to say we were wrong. Throw on the brakes. Let's call this thing off. Instead, you see this doubling down. It's a reluctance to admit that you were wrong. And then in this case, the vaccines were rushed by their own assertion at warp speed. We know from the history of science, anytime you rush something, especially when it's new, when it has innovative technologies, as often as not, there are unforeseen consequences. So now I think what we're seeing is a very perfidious doubling down attempt to conceal that this was wrong and that it's gotten a lot of people killed and maimed and injured as a result. So I don't expect to see the establishment say, you know, something, we got it wrong, sorry. I think it'll be a cold day in hell before that happens.
Well, the book we've been discussing is The Courage to Face COVID-19, Preventing Hospitalization and Death While Battling the Biopharmaceutical Complex. I'll link to it on our show notes page for today, which is tomwoods.com/2134. My thanks to both of you gentlemen for your time today. I know it's extremely valuable.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that will do it for another episode of The Tom Woods Show. On Monday, we're going to shift gears completely in terms of topics, and we're going to explore how Aristotle encourages you to live a good life. Check out the entire archive of episodes at tomspodcast.com, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.